Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You get an HQ, and you get an HQ. Amazon makes up its mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 13th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Amazon has officially made its HQ2 choice. Choice is, I guess, more properly, Crystal City, Virginia, just across the Potomac from Washington, and Long Island City in Queens, just across the East River from Manhattan. The details, I'm sure you know by now. 25,000 really well-paying jobs to each city, millions of square feet of office space to be rented. So we are going to skip the big picture and get down to street level, if you will. From New York, Marketplace's Mariel Segarra gets us going with what HQ2 might mean for people who might want to live in Long Island City.
Devin Garner has been dying to move out of his parents' apartment. His dream location? Long Island City.
You're literally in the center of everything, but you're away from everything at the same time.
Garner is 25, works in marketing in Manhattan. And for the past month, he's been looking at studios and one-bedroom apartments in Long Island City. And he says when he looked again today, rents had shot up.
Yeah, I can't afford it anymore. I mean, I could barely afford it. I mean, Long Island City was already an expensive place. But now, forget about it.
I called some real estate brokers, and they said maybe it won't be as bad as Garner thinks. There are a lot of new buildings in Long Island City, and the people who moved to Queens to work for Amazon aren't all going to end up living in the neighborhood.
I'm kind of personally more worried about my own neighborhood.
Kyle Karskadden is one of those brokers, and he lives in Sunnyside, Long Island City's more affordable neighbor.
I figure the people that don't want the new construction luxury, they want more, and people that want kind of the more old school tree-lined neighborhood streets will definitely end up in Sunnyside.
A wave of new residents could put pressure on people who've been living in Queens for a long time. Bob Engel with the Free and Fair Markets Initiative says the borough already has a shortage of affordable housing.
What's going to happen to the long-term residents, the people who built these communities, that made them what they are today, that develop the culture of these communities? What happens to them? We know what's going to happen to them. They're going to be displaced now.
And in New York City, there aren't many affordable neighborhoods left. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Something interesting happened on the way to a cooling housing market today. Home Depot, purveyor of all things home improvement, reported a better-than-expected quarterly profit this morning and raised its outlook for the rest of the year. Rising interest rates, as we've been telling you, and a lack of housing supply are helping to slow down the home sales that help drive Home Depot's profits. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, the company does make money when people stay put too, you know.
Inside a small red house in Denver, a worker straps on a pair of 3-foot metal stilts and clomps over to paint the dining room wall, a warm sort of taupe color. Leo Perez is co-owner of A&D Construction.
We are just remodeling the first floor, kitchen, half bath. We ripped out the old carpet.
She says the project is one of five the three-person crew is juggling right now.
What can I say? We're just glad that we are staying busy every day and can provide some work for our employees.
The company is also buying a lot of paint, lumber, and hardware from stores like Home Depot. The world's largest home improvement retailer says its third quarter sales were up almost 5.5% from a year ago. Analyst Jamie Katz at Morningstar says there are some signs of trouble. Existing home sales have fallen for 6 months in a row.
For every transaction that isn't happening in the housing market, you don't have anybody preparing their house for sale, and then you don't have anybody adapting the house to their own preferences when they move in.
But other forces will likely prop up spending on home renovations and repairs. Robert Dietz is chief economist of the National Association of Home Builders.
As individuals remain in their homes longer, they're likely to undertake those larger projects because simply their household has changed. Maybe they're adding kids or their kids are becoming teenagers and they have different space requirements for their homes.
He's predicting what had been double-digit growth for the remodeling business will slow to the single digits. A&D's Leo Perez says it's been a few years since she's been hired by someone selling a home.
It's kind of, we're staying here. We want to enjoy the house. That's why we're getting a lot of clients here now.
And just in case, she's saving for a time when the work dries up. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There was news out of the UK today that at first blush seemed big. Brexit negotiators, we were told, had made a breakthrough on the last big sticking point, what to do about the land border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. Cabinet meetings tomorrow, apparently lots of tea leaf reading ensued. But really, who knows? The BBC's political commentator Chris Mason summed it up.
So, where are we in all of this Brexit process? You know what? People like me are paid, aren't we, to have insight and foresight and hindsight about these things and to be able to project where we're going to go. To be quite honest, looking at things right now, I haven't got the foggiest idea what is going to happen in the coming weeks. Is the Prime Minister going to get a deal with the EU? Don't know. Is she going to be able to get it through the Commons? Don't know about that either.
Don't know. I mean, right? Come on, you'd pay money to hear that over here. Wall Street today, a little bit of a mixed bag. No big moves in either direction. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. ...2008, as we've been telling you this year, was a big year in this economy. There was Bear Stearns, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac being nationalized, Lehman Brothers and AIG. And then 10 years ago this month, the CEOs of Detroit's big three car makers going to Washington and asking for a bailout. GM and Chrysler and GMAC ultimately got $80 billion from both the Bush and Obama administrations to get them through bankruptcy and then back in business. It was a bet, really, on the auto workers and the communities across the Midwest that depend on the American car industry. As part of our year-long project on the financial crisis and the 10 years since, divided decade, we call it, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman went to Toledo, Ohio to see what winning that auto bailout bet looks like.
For a whole lot of people, times are good these days in Toledo, and that's thanks mostly to a vehicle made by one company, Fiat Chrysler.
Toledo speaks Jeep.
Jonathan Bridges grew up in a local autoworker family. Now he's an auto industry economist for Jobs Ohio.
Toledo has actually been a winner. We've been fortunate enough to have a historic product began here and continues to be strong with the Wrangler.
The scrappy military vehicle-turned-civilian off-road SUV definitely has the keys to the city. Jeep banners fly over major boulevards. A tricked-out Wrangler was parked in my hotel lobby. It's all because of this place, the Fiat Chrysler Jeep plant. 312 acres of advanced manufacturing and robotics.
You know, every 48, 50, 52 seconds, another vehicle comes off the line.
Media handler Jody Tinson told me that since 2009, Fiat Chrysler's invested $1.2 billion in retooling, automation, and model redesign. Employment's tripled to 5,600. Thousands more work at nearby parts suppliers to keep the lines running round the clock. A second plant's under construction to make a new Jeep pickup. Now, keep in mind, the government bailout didn't save the auto industry everywhere. The automakers had to downsize and restructure, reduce wages and benefits for union workers, cut production, and close plants. But Toledo got lucky. Its location on I-75 connects automakers in the north to foreign producers like Honda and Mercedes-Benz in the south. And its Jeep plant was up to date and ready for an upgrade.
Yeah, I think we have fully recovered. I mean, we are really rocking and rolling here in Toledo.
Bruce Baumhauer is president of United Auto Workers Local 12 in Toledo, which represents the Jeep plant and also half a dozen newly unionized parts suppliers. His membership has grown by 60% to over 10,000 since the bailout. Baumhauer says workers are still playing catch-up after the union made big concessions during the financial crisis. Pay was frozen for a decade for many workers. Those hired after 2007 still get lower pay and benefits than those hired earlier.
We don't have the traditional 30 and out pension plan for everybody. We've gone now to more 401ks. But on the hourly rate side and on the fact that they're making time and a half on Saturdays and double time on Sundays, pretty strong economy here in Toledo.
I met some of those auto workers after they finished a 10-hour night shift. It was 3:30 a.m., and we headed to a 24-hour big boy restaurant across town. Phil Reeder's 47. He was working in a print shop until he got laid off in the recession and signed on at Fiat Chrysler in 2013.
We started at $15.78 an hour, working alongside people on the line that had been there before 2007, you know, making 28-something an hour. So it still does cause some division amongst the workforce.
Reeder now makes $24 an hour, same as his coworker, John Moore. They'll reach $28 an hour in 5 years. Moore is 32, and he's supporting two young daughters. He came to Jeep in 2013 after working in distribution, retail, and restaurants.
The thing I think that caught me off guard was the wear and tear on the body. The schedule, the repetitive motion on the shoulders, the hips, the knees, the back. For the pay, it was good compared to working for $7 in a kitchen, but I was a whole lot more tired every day.
Moore grew up in a middle-class neighborhood in Toledo full of auto workers.
As a whole, the pay is good. Still a ticket to the middle class. Expectations for a lot of people of buying a house, buying a car, getting married, having kids, putting them through college, going on vacation? No. I'm doing better than I was, but I know I could be doing better than I am.
Same could be said for Toledo. It's doing a lot better than some places that lost their auto plants. But a quarter of local families live in poverty. The population's fallen since 2010, and the median household earns just $34,000 a year, a little over half the national average. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Mitchell's in Kenosha, Wisconsin tomorrow, where after making cars there for more than 100 years, Chrysler pulled the plug. Here with one story, three numbers to help get us into it. New international student enrollment in the fall of 2017, that is, students enrolling for the first time at a school in the States, was off nearly 7% from 2016. That's after a roughly 3% decline the year before. And international students, oh, by the by, contributed $42 billion to the American economy last year. But as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, that decline is not affecting all schools the same.
This fall, the number of international students in the freshman class at Iowa State University was down almost 30%, same for last year's class. Katherine Johnson-Suski is the director of admissions at Iowa State.
The specific things we hear from students are issues of racism, the fact that we're in a red state, issues with visas. They're concerned, can they get a visa? And if they get a visa, will they be able to stay in the U.S. with that visa?
To counteract those concerns, the schools created a video campaign to market to international students.
The College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at Iowa State University wants you to know you are welcome here.
You are welcome here.
我们欢迎你.
Iowa's competing against other U.S. schools for foreign students and the full tuition dollars they often represent. While the number of international students declined in the Midwest last year and was about flat in the South, it actually grew in the Northeast and the West. Anthony Carnevale is with the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce.
Every student you get who is full pay, it allows you to do merit-based aid to American students.
Plus, U.S. universities are increasingly competing with schools abroad. Benjamin Waxman with International Education Advantage helps colleges market themselves to foreign students.
Australia is working hard at it. New Zealand has totally opened up its employment rules. Canada, similar.
He says students knowing that they can stay and work in the country after graduation is a big draw. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Amazon gave us a great platform to say, see, look, we're in contention for this.
How the Amazon losers are using it to their advantage. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off an even 100 points today, 0.4%, 25,286. The NASDAQ barely moved, really, basically unchanged, finished at 7,200 on the nose. The S&P 500 down 4 points, about a 0.1%, 27.22 there. So Amazon dropped 0.3% today. Citigroup, by the way, announced it's moving more than 1,000 people out of its Queens offices to help accommodate the Amazon headquarters there. Citigroup packed up 0.8% today. Is Home Depot's paint can half full or half empty? As Amy Scott told us, cooling housing market could do some damage to the home building business. Home Depot down 0.2%. Today, rival Lowe's was basically unchanged. Bond prices? Well, thanks for asking. They rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 3.14%. And you are listening to Marketplace. We heard from Catherine in Bellingham, Washington the other day, who says she finds great value in how Marketplace explains things like tax reform and how changing fiscal policy affects our lives. If you agree with Catherine, please join her by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to Catherine and all the Marketplace investors who make our work possible.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Healthcare, of course, was the big issue in the midterms last week, but immigration, driven in large part by the inflammatory way the president used it in his campaign speeches, was a very close second. One place where the immigration debate is playing out in corporate practice is inside 7-Eleven convenience stores. Michael Smith wrote about it for Bloomberg Business Week. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about this war inside 7-Eleven. It's all about immigration and ICE and the folks who work at this company, right?
That's right. This is a story about a sort of a American dream story, if you will, of immigrants coming to the U.S., starting their own business, and it's called 7-Eleven. Time and time again, they described to me, the franchisees, that this was the American dream for them, and that's the way they always saw 7-Eleven. They poured their life into this company and into their stores, and now they just feel like they've been sort of betrayed, and it, at the center of it all is really immigration.
ICE agents are actually going into stores and demanding documents and asking the questions about where are you born and how long have you worked here and all that.
That's right. We saw that this year. It's starting the beginning of the year when just before dawn, agents fanned out across the United States, almost 100 stores in multiple states. And they basically went in and asked the store owners where they're from, where are the employees from, show me your ID, are you American? And they demanded years of employment records to see whether they've been complying with the law. There have been multiple raids of these types targeting the franchisees, which are the people who actually own the stores, not the company itself.
And you document or lay out a series of pieces of evidence that seem to corroborate an uneasy relationship between corporate headquarters, the company itself, and a lot of these franchise owners, many of whom are immigrants.
It's just been an ongoing sort of conflict that's been played out in the courts and been played out in this sort of immigration arena, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it all boils down to the company itself wanting to get a bigger piece of the revenue coming from the franchisees, and the franchisees have pushed back on that.
Is it a good living to own a 7-Eleven franchise?
Well, the franchisees complain that it's not, and if you look at the numbers, you can see why they feel that way. 7-Eleven has become much more sophisticated, as has the retail market, if you will. So they're selling a lot of fresh foods, pizza, stuff like that, also other items that are sort of cost a lot more to stock and maintain. And they just feel like the economics are going to get worse and worse until you just can't make a living running a 7-Eleven, believe it or not.
The hammer here, of course, is that if they're caught in violation of labor law to a certain degree, they could lose their franchise. That voids the agreement and the company can take it back.
That's correct. In fact, they just took back 8 stores owned by a leader of the Franchisee Association in Chicago. And they cited immigration issues as one of the reasons for doing it. So when they take back the stores, by the way, they don't have to pay the store owner a penny. So you basically lose your life savings if you lose your store to the company.
Obviously, you called 7-Eleven. What did they have to say about all this?
Well, they say they're just trying to comply with the law. They say they don't target franchisees for takeover for reasons like being a, you know, outspoken opponent to their policies. Yeah. They deny having sort of ratted store owners out to ICE, which is what a lot of them seem to think has happened. Store owners say that, you know, there's always been a sort of an understanding. You're running your own business. You can let family members work there, whatever. You know, it was sort of tolerated that you would run it the way you needed to make enough money to survive. And then there was this crackdown that revolved around the very thing that brought them to this country, which is immigration.
Michael Smith, he writes for Bloomberg Business Week most recently in a piece called The War Inside 7-Eleven. Michael, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
We're going to go back to the Amazon HQ2 Palooza here for a minute and talk about one of the cities that didn't make it to the big dance. You know, one of the cities that spent all that money and all those hours gathering all that data to put together a pitch that, as we learned today officially, went nowhere. Or did it? From WESA in Pittsburgh, one of Amazon's top 20, by the way, but not one of its top 2, Marketplace's Erica Barris takes a look at what might be the real payoff.
I'm with Pittsburgh City Councilwoman Deborah Gross, and we're driving through what's known as Robotics Row. Apple, Facebook, and Uber are just a few of the big names in this 15-block stretch close to downtown Pittsburgh.
There's probably not a place where this many technology innovators in competition with each other are next-door neighbors.
All those companies have taken up residence in the past decade or so, transforming empty warehouses into offices and labs. The city didn't have to do much to court them. They came to take advantage of the area's highly skilled labor force. And, Rose says, not much has improved since the company showed up.
There's not even sidewalk space. So there's no pedestrian infrastructure. There's no safety infrastructure. There were no streetlights.
Amazon has an office here, too. But when the company announced it was looking for a second headquarters, Pittsburgh realized it was going to take a lot to lure Amazon a second time. So more than 400 people from government, business, and higher ed, along with a team of highly paid consultants, studied every aspect of the region to prepare the 300-page proposal for HQ2.
If it takes a catalyst like that to bring people together in a room to really assess what our needs are, what our social needs are, what our infrastructure needs are, and how we can do better to meet them, that's not a bad thing.
What did they learn? The city schools? Not that great. The transportation system? Hard to get from here to there. And when it comes to ethnic diversity, the region is lacking. David Rupersberger with the Pittsburgh Regional Alliance worked on the proposal.
We recognized that the odds were long, but we also recognized early on that there was going to be benefit to this, regardless of whether we're selected or not. And we feel like we've already won.
One, because Pittsburgh now has a detailed and data-rich profile of itself that it can use to drive improvement. And since making it onto Amazon's short list of finalists, other companies have come calling.
What I would call mini Amazons.
Like Affirm, a financial tech company that said last month it'll set up a big office in Pittsburgh. There was also this.
Fly connection free to Seattle? It's the real deal, Pittsburgh. Get from the Steel City to the Emerald City in just a few hours on a new nonstop flight.
Pittsburgh was already in line for the flight, but Christina Kasatosis, CEO at the Pittsburgh Airport, said the timing looked good nonetheless and made it easier to court other airlines and flights.
Amazon gave us a great platform to say, see, look, we're in contention for this. And that was really, that was a fantastic calling card for us.
As some cities have learned, sometimes just being a contender is enough. Let's go back to the 90s. United Airlines was looking to build a new maintenance facility that would create 5,000 jobs. The finalists were Indianapolis and Oklahoma City. When Indianapolis won, Oklahoma City pressed United to reveal why. Former Mayor Mick Cornett.
So they finally disclosed that they had sent in some mid-level executives and their spouses and asked them to spend a weekend in Oklahoma City and report back to the board of directors in Chicago. And when the board looked at that report, they just decided they couldn't imagine their employees living there.
It was hard to hear, but it spurred the city to improve its downtown and outdoor space with hotels and restaurants and bring in sports teams. And those changes attracted new companies. Cornett says the United facility was
the best thing that didn't happen.
Years from now, some cities may be saying the same thing about Amazon HQ2. In Pittsburgh, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, in which the European Union strikes a blow for liberty. The Court of Justice over there ruled today that a Dutch cheesemaker cannot copyright the taste of its cheese. Taste, the court wrote, is an idea rather than expression of an original intellectual creation. So there you go. Just in case you weren't paying attention, and full disclosure, Amazon, given all the coverage we did today, is one of the underwriters of this program. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials down 100 points, the century mark for the blue chips, 0.4%. NASDAQ was basically flat. S&P 500 off 4 points, 0.1%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Heathcoat is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Cesar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.